So, just wanted to say that next week, Olivia will be with us. Olivia Johnston, next week, next month. Thank you. And I have no idea what she's going to talk about. Yeah, I said, tell me at least 2 weeks ahead of the meeting. So that's what I'll find out. And also, Jim turned me on to a movie called Tim's Vermeer. And it's very much about photography. I would say this guy is the first photographer. It's just the capture process was a little bit different. Hand painting. He worked with mirrors to allow him to do photorealistic painting in the 1700s.
Interesting.
It's just a fascinating movie, and it's on for at least 2 more days. Maybe it's at the Viscount. Raymond is going to talk to us about big panoramas, 360 degree.
Okay, good night, everyone. I hope my voice will be, I don't have a very strong voice, so if I'm not loud enough, you just tell me. When I got my first digital camera around 2000 or thereabout, I asked myself, what can I do with this thing that always interested me that I couldn't do before? And panoramas was one of the things that came out. This is a project I did before the webcam photo project. Panoramas are quite interesting. As with many other things that turned out to be much easier with digital photography, people made panoramas in the 19th century. There's one famous panorama of Montreal made by Notman, which is, I think, I have the date here, it's in 1896. And I think it's on display at the McCord Museum in Montreal, or it's visible. It's interesting, you can see the stitches and everything, but it's a good 180 degrees, if not more, view of Montreal. And we all know that in the 20th century, there were panoramic cameras available. Hasselblad had one. The famous Horizon Russian camera that had a sweeping lens, and a couple of other models. So it's not a new topic. However, as you can imagine, digital changes a lot of things regarding panoramas. So what I'd like to do, I'll talk a little bit about my choices, but then I'll move to, after that, talking about Jeffrey James, who is a photographer who actually used panoramas and actually thought about panoramas. So I'll say a bit more when we get there. So there's really two things one has to decide before launching into making a panorama is, okay, what's going to be my angle of view? Okay, I chose 260 degrees. And what is going to be my image ratio? Okay. If you look at this panorama up there, it's a 360 degrees panorama of this room. And the ratio is about 3:1. I think sort of less than 3:1, you're not talking about panoramas. And all these cameras, I think, the Hasselblad, Horizon, whatever, they were pretty much doing 3:1 panoramas. Okay. Huh? Yeah, exactly. The height to weight. 3:1 is basically the width to height. Okay. Now, I chose a pretty radical, so I said 360 degrees. That's not necessarily radical, but I chose a really radical ratio of 20:1. Okay? And the reasons for that, I'm going to get to those reasons in a minute. Some other choices, well, first of all, let me backtrack one step, is that I decided to shoot in public places, which made the thing a little bit more of a challenge. But my topic, whether it's, you know, for those who were here when I talked about webcam photography, or things that I did in the past also had to do with public places and also street photography. So, okay, let's make 360-degree panoramas on the street in public places. Also, I chose a low viewpoint in conjunction with the subject of the street. The camera is about that height, about less than waist height. Okay, so about like this, more or less. Maybe a little bit lower than that. I also made another choice, which is to have a sharp background, as sharp as I could get it, but to have my passersby blurred. Okay, so to create contrast, I'll say a little bit more about this. Having blurred passersby is something that people have done with street photography. So there is a sort of a link between the aesthetics of the blur and street photography throughout the history of street photography, actually. And finally, it may sound obvious, but it is not. I decided that my panoramas would be very similar. In other words, stitches will not show. If you look at Notman's panorama from the 19th century, the stitches show because the technology would have been extremely difficult to make these stitches disappear. But also with sort of in contemporary photography, some people made the choice to, okay, I'm gonna leave the stitches in. It's a choice. It's an aesthetic choice. So my choice was, it's gonna be very similar. Okay. So now that really sets the table about what I was after when I started with this project. Now, let me move to Jeffrey James for a minute. He had a show at the National Gallery in 2008. Some people may have seen the show. And he had a section on panoramas. And I saw the show. I bought a catalog. And in the catalog also, there's a section on panoramas where the author, I forget his name, the guy who wrote on the show, talks about panoramas. And also there's a lot of documentation on James on the website of the National Gallery. There are interviews and there's even transcripts, I think, of his interviews. And James makes a very strong statement. First of all, well, he was, of course, working with one of those cameras on film with, I think he had a sweeping... No blacks? Okay, there you are. In one case, at one point, he had more than one, but at one point he had one of these sweeping lenses. Yeah. And a curve plane. That's an image. This is a quote from James. "The panoramic camera allowed me to find my voice in photography." That's a very strong statement, eh? And this is about the only place in this catalog and in James' writing where I saw some thoughts or thinking on panoramic photography. And here's what he says, or this is either him or the person who wrote, sorry for him, I forget what his name is, the person who wrote who wrote the catalog. First, two things really. One is the panorama introduces a narrative. Now, the word narrative we have to be a little bit careful about, because sometimes you look at a picture and you say, okay, this picture tells a story. There's a narrative in this picture. But typically what we mean is that in my imagination, I can picture what came after the instance the photo was made and what might come after it. Okay? So the narrative is imaginary in terms of action, where, let's say, the picture is like one frame through this action. This is not what James talks about at all.
And before also.
And before, exactly, yeah. Before and after. What James talked about, and frankly, you have to be in a 3-to-1, no less than 3-to-1 ratio to see that happen, is more like a physical narrative where you move through the picture. Not, you know, at one extreme you have a square picture, you move, maybe your eye moves like this in the picture. It's not really a narrative. But when you have something that's long, you start moving this way, and then your movement of your eyes, maybe of your head, And when you have a very long panorama of your whole body, that alone creates a narrative. Now, that's not me speaking here. That's James and his the writer of the catalog. So it's a narrative in a physical sense. It's very different. Now, suddenly you're in a very different world from a photo. And the second big change is that the rules of composition change completely. Forget the rule of thirds, okay? It just doesn't work. You have to reimagine something. You have to base your picture on something that is totally different. No rules of third. And if you look at James's panoramas, you'll find a number of variants of composition. But there's one that he talks about, which is extremely interesting, I think, that he pushed in a number of his pictures, is basically to... you can sort of see his 3-to-1 picture as three square pictures. Okay? And... The middle one tends to be a sort of a pivotal image, and the right and the left ones are, you know, stand on their own. So I don't have an example of his work here, but just to give you what it might look like, you have a panorama of a small industrial town. And you have a house with a truck there in a driveway on the right, and you have a tree in the middle, and you have the factory at the back on the leftmost picture. So now you're making the house and the truck of the worker, so to speak, connected with the factory. And he had a couple like that. He has beautiful shots of lanes in Toronto where you have, like, again, you have one world going this way, and you have another world going that way, and you have something in the middle linking the two. It's really fascinating when you spend the time. For people who are intrigued, you can go on the site of the National Gallery. So anyway, he was a little bit of my mentor, so to speak, in he helped me put clarity in my thoughts. Now, another influence, a parallel influence, but very much related, strangely enough, is that of the Chinese scroll. And that's the reason why I went for the 20-to-1 ratio. Going back about the same time when I started to do these panoramas, I started to get interested in Chinese aesthetics, and particularly Chinese rolls, scrolls. So the Chinese scrolls, they were made to be kept rolled and basically unrolled section by section to be looked at. Sometimes they would actually be displayed as friezes. And I remember I went to China in 2006, and I remember being in a temple where you had basically one of those panoramas going around, completely around this room in the temple, and it was absolutely fascinating, basically walking around. So it was like a photo show, except it's like one picture. Because the way Chinese scrolls are built is like there isn't really... It's not like one place. It's like multiple places, but they're all connected. So you have... think about what I said concerning James's pictures, okay? You have, I don't know, you have a peasant with an ox, whatever, plowing a field, and then you have a house, and then you have a mountain, you have a temple, and then you have the emperor, and you have soldiers, and you have, and you have, and you have, and you have. And it keeps going like this all around the room, right? And you're not sure whether you're in one space. In fact, you realize you're not in one space, but any little piece that you look at, you're still within the one space. It's really interesting and intriguing. So I was influenced by that vision. And also, now it definitely introduces a narrative. The Chinese scroll really works like a story, and a story you move and so on. Now, let me just make a digression here. Another similar thing I saw, but not a single image, connected image, is maybe we all have had that experience, but one in particular was in Chicago at the Art Institute of Chicago, and there's one room where you had the whole series of Bruce Davidson's Metro pictures, the only work he did in color. And it's a little bit like that. You have this fairly large empty room except for all these prints all around. And you walk like this. Now, they're all separate prints, but they're all in the same kind of location, which is the subway in New York. And they all have the same type of aesthetics, same color, more or less, and whatever. And it's a little bit of sort of the same feeling that you get, except that the images are disconnected. So, but my point is that your body gets involved in moving. You don't necessarily stop still. Maybe you do partly in front of one picture and then move to a completely different world. No, it's like you're in the same world as you move around the room. I think it was a permanent, I'm not sure whether it was a temporary permanent show, but if you ever go to Chicago, any photographer should go and see that. And that was precisely what I was interested in, like changing the physical relationship between the viewer and a photograph. Okay. I talked about the sharp and the blurred. That's another Chinese influence, although I mentioned street photography has always dealt with the blur. In Chinese paintings in general, you often have that. You have fine drawing with ink, China ink, and then you have these large, again, with ink, but using the brush, large segments that are really soft, really, really, really soft, and then you have things that are really sharp. I have a few pieces at home, and they're so much like that. It's a striking difference between the sharp and the blur in these pictures. So that was another influence. Now, actually, before I move to the question of shooting conditions, I brought one of those. I can show it because the colors are a little bit off and it had to be reprinted. So I can manipulate it and I don't have to worry about whether I dent it or whatever. Anyway, just to give you an idea.
You want some more hands?
Yeah, this is about, what is it, a foot and a half high? But that's 24 feet long. I'm not sure we're going to be able to unroll it completely, but now this is taken at the airport in Montreal. Okay, now it keeps going like this for double the length, because that's maybe if we. Well, let's try to unroll it completely. Yeah, we have to go down. So what happens with a panorama like this? Well, first of all, you can see now you have to walk along and then you look at little scenes. Okay, this is what I was talking about when you look at the Chinese scroll. That's the feeling you get. But also, When you take a 360 degree picture like this one and a 3-to-1 ratio, you get a lot of distortion. With this, you hardly get any distortion. In fact, you sort of lose the sense that this is a 360 degree thing. It could be anything, right? Because another way to do a panorama would be to move your camera like this along a sidewalk, for example, and you know, do it for as long as you want, right? So there is very little distortion visible. Well, a little bit there, on the benches they're a bit curved, but otherwise it's pretty.
Two questions.
Yeah.
What millimeter of lens are you using?
This is a 70 on an APS-C format, equivalent to a 105 on full format. Now, there's a certain amount of mathematics in figuring out what kind of lens you want for a particular kind of situation. But
how long is this?
It's about 25 feet, 24, I think. It's that order, yeah.
Who printed it for you?
This was printed at Diamond in Gatineau. And it was a challenge because you have to use a rip. Yeah. Can't do this with normal stuff. And I'm not sure that at the time you couldn't do it on a Mac. You had to do it on a PC because that rip was not available on the Mac. So,
how much did it charge?
I forget. It's not all that expensive, really, because I actually, in that case, I bought the roll. I came, you know, this is an enhanced mat or whatever. A roll like this is not very expensive, so I bought the roll, like, because they couldn't reuse the roll. So I bought the roll, I went there with the roll, put it in the machine, and then just put it in.
Okay, I'll talk later.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's what it looks like, and I did a fair number of those, and I'll see a little bit more about the shooting conditions and the post-processing conditions. But that's what it looks like.
So these people were just awfully still? Otherwise, they would be blurred?
Yeah. People that are not blurred are still, but then some people who are... like this guy is coming in, and these other guys are sitting there. Actually, this guy's tying his shoes. So this may be a bad example because some people are already still. I took two panoramas downtown Toronto and the corner of Dundas and Yonge, and now you really have people walking by, everybody is blurred, basically, right? Yeah.
Like a 15th or a 30th.
No. It's lower than that. It's 1/8, roughly, 1/8 of a 1/8 of a second to get the effect I want. 1/15, 1/8, 1/4 is too slow, too slow. Yeah.
How long does it take to get this shot, or is this an instant,
Okay. Maybe if this is okay, I'll roll it and I'll answer your question. I'll roll it back.
Okay.
Je pense que j'avais un... OK, j'ai un petit collant. Non, je pense que je suis correct. Je vais juste donner un petit peu de tension. OK. So I did a fairly large number of those, maybe a dozen, maybe close to 15 altogether in various locations. I was looking at buildings, airports. Did one at a bus terminal in the metro of Montreal, several, half a dozen there. Downtown Toronto, as I said, downtown Hull, downtown Ottawa, a few as well. So I was looking for... you know, that type of public places. Now, just a few technical points to answer your question, although I don't really want to dwell in technology, but basically, I'm using a tripod with a panoramic head. A must, of course. Focal length just come out of a calculation. If you want to do a 360 degrees, 20-to-1 ratio, plug the number... and the numbers in the formula, and you get the 70mm and APS-C. Of course, for anyone who attempted to do panoramas, is everything manual. It's no automatic at all. manual focus, because I wanted to have everything sharp, I closed the diaphragm down to its maximum, and I set the distance on, I set the focus on the hyperfocal distance to get maximum. Okay, so I was sharp from about 3 meters to infinity with that lens and that setup. So that's a condition where I place myself. I pretty much have to have things clear for about 3 meters around me. Okay, just to have everything sharp. But for people, more or less 1/8 of a second, I would run some tests. Now, the biggest challenge is setting up exposure. Because now it's two issues. One is I asked for a certain aperture, which was f/29, and I asked for a certain speed, which is 1/8, but light conditions vary. So I have neutral density filters to cut down the light, also play with ISO setting within limits, maybe 800 in the cave with my camera, and play with those until I get something that is nice and average across the whole 360. Because, you know, if there are exposure variations within one, when you take one frame, when 360, it can be quite wide. That's why inside is okay. Like in this case, you could see walls, but then you could see also the door, which is a little bit more bright, a bit brighter. But in general, you have to do this if you're outside when it's overcast, because then that's going to minimize the light differential. And also, you don't want to deal with shadows, because then you have someone standing. If there's no shadows, the only thing you have to worry about is that person. If there's a shadow, you have to worry about the person and the shadow. And suddenly it gets really big what you have to deal with. So no sun, no, that's a no-no. And getting to your question, each panorama contains 48 pictures. And again, you plug the numbers, it comes out 48 pictures. You have to shoot 48 pictures, which means that a panoramic head, in this case, has to be set at 7.5 degrees. So it's moving, it's dented, and you move it every time you take a new image, a new shot, you move it by 7.5 degrees. If that technology, if you don't like it, just tell me. This is really...
Okay.
Yeah, there is a... You never want to go under less than 20% overlap. So it's between 20 and 40% overlap.
And why do you say 20?
If there is not enough overlap, the stitching is going to be difficult.
If you've got a great variance between, let's say, 20 and 40% overlap, do you have to be very precise in your 7.5 degree rotation?
No, it's okay. Well, the head has specific settings, and then it turns out there's one at 7.5, and there's one at 10, and there's one at whatever. So you have to choose. You have to put your head, find the degree that you need to do the panorama. And so it's 48 images in that picture, but of course I take many, many more, typically double that, because this is a complete creation. Those people were not there at the same time. I was there for 30 minutes waiting for people to come. And in principle, at each notch on the head, I could take a shot. I would take a shot with nobody to make sure I have at least a clear background. And then I would wait until something interesting comes in front, and I would take one or several person at that location, and I would go ahead and do it like this. Maybe not all locations, whatever, it depends. Because, of course, you're talking about moving people, so it's not something that you control. But that shot took probably 30 minutes, and I could have taken 90, double that, maybe 90 pictures or something like that, 90 shots. And then when I get back home, I build a picture. Okay, I want somebody here, I want somebody there. And if you notice, I tried because of the concept, I tried to not to have groups, so I eliminated groups. It's just like individual people, because I want to show whatever individuality or loneliness within the public space. So I don't want groups. In this picture, there's one place, there's two people talking, but that's it. Okay? Everybody else is by himself or herself. And then when I get home, as I said, I build a picture, I put someone there, maybe it doesn't work. No, I put another person there, and something, the matching color of jackets and how people, what people wear and expressions and you name it. I build it from zero. In fact, I'm building from the 96 images I have. So it's completely fake.
Right?
Now, completely built, not faked. Okay. Now, I mentioned that's going to be my last little piece before opening things for discussion. I mentioned that I use a tripod, and it will take me, in fact, the fastest I was able to do one of those was 10 minutes. Okay, so typically it's 20, 30 minutes. So, long shooting time, and interesting locations like the Montreal Metro and the Ottawa Airport and whatever. So I needed permission. I needed to have permission to do it. And typically, I've learned. At first, I didn't ask for permission, but very quickly, people started to notice me. So I said, okay, but I asked for permission. I have to ask for permission. If people say yes, fine, I do it. If people say no, I pass. I don't insist. Now, if you go somewhere, there are two groups you can ask permission to. You can go to public relations or you can go to security. You don't want to go to security. They say no.
It's in the playbook.
You go to public relations. You go to public relations and you explain your stuff. They say, oh, gee, nice stuff. You tell me when you're done. Send me whatever info when you finish and if you have whatever, whatever. Okay? And you want to have the email with you from the person from public relation, because I've been regularly stopped by security saying, very nicely, you have permission to take photos here. And I pull my email. In some cases, in the Montreal Metro, I had to pay. It cost me $100 for 1 hour. And $100 for 1 hour. In fact, it was a deal. Apparently, they're flooded with requests to people have to have photos and shoot films and whatever in the Montreal Metro. So it's gated, and they said if I'd been shooting a professional movie or something, it would cost me $250 an hour. But because I'm an artist, blah blah blah, blah, cost me $100 an hour. I had someone sitting beside me. I had, ahead of time, I had a very clear idea of everywhere I wanted to go. This is where I had 10 minutes per location, rushing madly, 6 panoramas. 2 were crap, not uninteresting, and 4 turned out to be pretty interesting. Okay. But go, 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 rush, rush, rush. Oh, yeah, I've got to mention something, or maybe I mentioned it rather briefly. You can't take these things in any sort of location. I mentioned that I needed to have a radius of about 3 meters that is free, because I didn't want to have things that are unsharp. But then, of course, people could walk through this, but that's okay, because then they're going to be blurred by their movement. So it doesn't work in all locations. I found through trial and error. You need to have something that's fairly round in a sense. Like this waiting hall. In fact, yeah, this waiting hall is a hall. And there's no big vistas there. It's a sort of pretty enclosed area. If you have a vista, you have to be very careful that it's you don't have too many, and it, you understand where your vistas are, because a vista creates a big hole in the image, in a creates perspective and so on. So finding the place turns out to be rather difficult. When I was downtown Toronto, I walked and walked and walked and walked, and I found two places that really met my criteria. One was in front of the entrance to the Eden Center, and the other one was there's a little plaza at the corner of Dundas and Yonge. And frankly, that was it. Although I'm sure there are other places, but like, same thing Montreal, most places didn't work. So you have to, after a certain amount of trial and error, you figure out, okay, I think this is gonna work as a location or not, okay? So, need permission. I guess what didn't work is that you lose the flatness. I was looking for a sort of flatness.
So you didn't want high rise.
Well, because I'm low anyway, I'm trying to avoid having vistas to get the feeling of the Chinese scroll feeling where you get it's very flat, okay, and the telephoto lens helped me with that flatness. And if the location didn't work, because in terms of James says something quite similar about his 3-to-1 panoramas. He writes something about how difficult it is to find a location that will work. Okay, for even for a 3-to-1 panorama of the kind he wants to make. Yeah? Now I'm going to close on two anecdotes regarding permission. One was at Ottawa Airport, where I had permission from public relations, and great, I had my paper, and I was shooting just in front of the lineup for security, people who went through there, and there's a first checkpoint where someone asked whether you have water bottles or whatever. So I was shooting there, and again around adding people carefully, and it was taking time. Oh, sorry, I'm going to backtrack again. The amount of people is critical as well. If there's too many people, you can't do it, because every time you take a slice, it's going to be full of people. You want to isolate someone. But if there's too few people, you can wait for, you know, minutes before someone shows up in that little slice. So I knew someone working at Montreal Airport, and he said, you want to be there between before noon. So afternoon, there's going to be too many people, and that's going to be over. And it was over by noon. Impossible to work, because every time I was looking, it was full of people. And you see, I can't cut someone in half. Right? So when I shoot someone, it's got to be the only thing I see and not parts of bodies. It's got to be a full one body of a person, okay? So if there's too many people, that's out. So that's something to be really careful about. And if there are too few people, then again, there's not enough action and it's boring. You got to wait until there's some action. So that's another thing that's critical. So anyway, I was shooting at Ottawa Airport, and I said, I was telling myself, I can't believe I'm shooting right in front of security and nobody's stopping me, and this is just unreal. Of course, my agreement with public relations was that I was not, of course, going on the other side of the secure, where the search people and everything. But still, there was the guy from Nexus, the American guy from Nexus with the American flag and everything. I said, I can't believe it. And then, of course, after about 15 minutes, someone comes, security, are you... what are you doing? Yeah, I'm taking a picture. You got permission? Yes, here's my... Oh, Mrs. So-and-so. Okay. Fine. I said, okay, game over, I'm sure. But by the time, I was done. And about 4 minutes later, the lady comes down to where I was. You better go and shoot somewhere else. Security doesn't like it very much, you to be here, blah, blah, blah. No problem. Always say yes, right? Fold the tripod, go somewhere, but I had my panorama. The first problem I had was with OC Transpo. This was in the fall of 2007, and I was shooting by the transit way on a tripod. And here's this agent from OC Transpo comes to me and says, you're not allowed to shoot. What do you mean I'm not allowed to shoot? I'm on a sidewalk. You're not allowed to shoot. So, of course, you don't want to argue. You cannot argue with these guys. And then he goes and, okay, that's okay. I think he's just blah, 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 blah. Okay. So what's going on? I said, you're not, go and talk to public relations, you know, city public relations. So I call the guys, I send an email, call the guys, no response, call the guys, no response. In the meantime, I go, I do a little search, and I find that there is a bylaw that was voted in June 2007 regarding taking photos in conjunction with OC Transpo. And I will read out what this says. Strangely enough, the full text of the bylaw was available only in French. So good for me. Anyway, I'll translate as I go. It says, it is forbidden to use a camera, a video camera, any other similar apparatus on a property of a public transport property without permission, explicit written permission from the director. The director, the head of the whatever. Okay. What is a property? What is a public transport property? Any property owned, leased, or used by the city to deliver a public transport system to passengers, including transitway bus stops, even those parking lots, you know, where you, okay? And then there's a list of platforms, light train, of course, on the bus you can't do it, any bus stops, as I said, any platform, blah, 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 blah.
Just by coincidence, earlier today I was reading up on photographers' rights in Ontario and the new copyright law. Now, I don't know exactly what always constitutes public property and whether bus stops are considered public property. I mean, I can see the transitway might not be considered public property, but, you know, like Bank Street, I mean, there's buses. Is that public property or is that...
I'll give you one indication of how controlled it is. If you're smoking at a bus stop, you will be fine. It's a finable area within 9 meters of either side of the actual stop.
Well, if you're standing across the street, anyway.
No, it's 9 meters, which means not up and down the street, in any direction from the stop sign, from the bus stop sign, it is illegal to consume a cigarette. So that means if you're standing on the white line in the middle of the street, a Bank Street, you are breaking the law if you are at a bus stop.
Well, okay, this was a...
Here, it gets better. If you're in your car, hold your breath as you drive by. You're in the stop zone.
Well, okay, but this was about photographers' rights in Ontario. And there, no one can restrict your right to take
a picture
of a public place in a public place.
Except?
Unless there are strict security things or harassing a person or you know, something like that. But this is a government town, and I'm not sure.
Well, the reason it is, it's very special with public transit, because public transit is often the target of terrorists. And after 9/11, all public transit was regarded as being high risk.
Yep.
And
yeah, that's what it is.
Category,
yeah.
As does the C-way.
I'm not disputing that, but what I'm getting at is, you know, what constitutes public...
They decide that, and typically to be on the safe side, they put it really broad, right?
It's really and then it's very broad.
To be in their on the safe side for them, they put it really broad. This is really broad.
Just saying, I'm just speaking generally.
Yeah.
I mean, are the Parliament buildings public property? Or
No, they are controlled security zones.
Okay, well, all right, but I'm just saying that no one, and security guards don't know this, and often, you know, but unless I put all this. copyright stuff and Ontario photography laws in a little Ziploc bag, which I put in my camera bag. And, you know.
Okay, good luck. I mean, when you deal with a security guard,
is the guy's job is to make sure that he doesn't get fired.
Exactly.
And the way he doesn't get fired is making sure you have a bad day.
Yeah, it's not exactly. Yeah.
So,
now, I think I was the first one testing the system.
Oh, yeah.
Because when I talk to public relations, they say, okay, what is this? Never, we're going to do our homework because we don't know what it is. Yeah. Anyway, just to complete the story, they finally sent me to security, which I wanted to avoid. Okay? So I said, I'm going to go to the bottom of this, follow the rules, and go see how far I can go. So I said, I sent an email and said, listen, I would like to be able, because I had this, overcast problem, right? Can't go anytime. So I said, listen, I'm going to, anytime that particular week, from Monday to Friday, or whatever, 3 days in the week, because I looked at the weather forecast, I knew it was going to be overcast, blah, blah, blah. Anytime between whatever 1 and 4, whatever it was, I forget exactly, right? And by the time, this was in October, by the time we were sort of in November, here's the letter I received. Mr. Aubin, I've reviewed your application. I appreciate your desire to take photos of our system. With the recent events in the world, the safety and security of our passengers and employees is paramount. You have requested an unencumbered access for a considerable amount of time. At this time, I cannot grant permission for the duration you ask. Thank you for your interest you have shown in OC Transport, blah, blah. So by the time, anyway, it was late November, it was cold. So I said, I sent an email back to her and I said, I'll call you again in March, in May next year. Well, May the following year, I want to test the friggin' system. Sorry. So I sent her an email. I said, I want to do my project. Now it's warm again, blah, 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 blah. Okay, show the email. You told me that. Fine. I'm asked to go to the headquarters, security headquarters on Saint Laurent. Bring your passport. Brought my passport. Identify myself. And they check, they go take my passport, go with my passport, check whatever. And they said, okay, that's fine. And I said, I want to go to the lease station. This time was specific. To the lease station, whatever, Wednesday morning, blah, blah, blah. Okay, for an hour. We go there, make an appointment with a security personnel who stood by me for an hour. Well, I was shooting my panorama at the lease station. I shot two, whatever.
So, work.
Huh?
Tax dollars at work.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to share that anecdote because to me this is so unbelievably typical of how the paranoia has gone. I'm not too sure now. Like this is 6-7 years ago. 6 years ago. It's already quite some time ago, and people tend to get it's a new bylaw, get whatever, and then things ease out, whatever. But I thought it was an interesting story. And also, it shows that when you do this type of work, there's no question of stealing your pictures. You have to take the time, hence have permissions, yeah?
What was the year of the bylaw?
June 2007.
2007.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing, like when I shot in the Montreal Metro, and I had to photograph for Bombardier, the supplier of the cars. And Bombardier obviously has a lot of pull. But one of the things that they did that I thought was really interesting is every security person had my picture. That even if they were on vacation, they had my picture. Every employee who may have interacted with me had my picture. It's as simple as that.
Uh-huh.
And the public relations person, at Bombardier, handled all that. And what she did that I thought was fascinating, she came and she was with me that day. And she had absolute total permission for me to photograph. So when I was approached by security at an inopportune moment, she asked for his name. And she said, this station is under my control today. And he was like, what? And she says, if you're not aware of that, you should be taken away by security. There's a problem that you don't know.
Yeah.
And that was the level that she had brought it to. So I didn't have to do any of that. But so I think if I ever go into the Metro, everyone will know.
So she obviously was experienced with that kind of stuff.
In Montreal, all of the city of Montreal is a zone that you have to pay to do professional photography. The whole city. They have a wonderful production office at City Hall that you can go to. If you'd like to have a particular restaurant or some section of the street in Montreal for your movie production, they will handle everything necessary to convince everyone that you have lots of money and are willing to fork it over so they can have a good day. They're very well organized. It can work for you and it can really work against
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
If you break the rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to say, my own rule is yes, sir.
Yeah.
You have to say yes, sir. You can't, I mean, I argued once and I figured out quickly that not worth it. So it's yes, sir.
There is a hierarchy of laws in Ontario. And bylaws, like the one you referred to there, are no different than parking laws. That's all they are. It's, you know, they're bylaws. They're enforced by bylaw enforcement people. When you get a ticket, you know, parking or jaywalking or leaving your garbage out too long. But provincial law and privacy and photographers' rights is provincial legislation. And that supersedes a bylaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because bylaw is just enforced by the same people that get parking tickets. Or the special constables on OC transport.
The Municipal Act, the way it works is any municipal law that's passed has to go to the Solicitor General in Toronto, who then basically looks at it and analyzes whether or not the city has acted responsibly.
Oh, okay.
And so the province is fully aware of that.
Yeah, but what I'm just saying, in the hierarchy of, you know...
There's really no hierarchy. Because the way it works is if I don't pay my parking ticket, which is a municipal act, I will go and try and renew my provincial license and be told I can't. And at that time, they will ask me why I haven't paid my support to my wife, my ex-wife, who lives in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
So it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah.
It is all connected. Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, on a practical level, like, you know, security is always, they can always fly that flag.
Security always stands in front of your camera?
Well, the issue of security.
No.
Security.
The practicality of it is, security officers simply stand in front of your camera, and they say, no. And you can say anything you want about laws, you know, this is the hierarchy, this, that, and the other thing, and you can say, I'm going to sue you, I'm going to do all these things. But the practicality of it is you're going to stand there and look at the guy's tummy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's just not going to look.
Something...
So, you need to approach it in a...
I didn't mean security officers. I mean the principle or the way of refusing your request because of security concerns and terrorism and 9/11 and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they can always use that justified.
I was never stopped on the street except for this, which I thought I was on the street, but maybe I wasn't. Okay. But regarding buildings, there's really two categories. Typically, in a private building, it's a flat no. If it's a public or semi-public building, you stand a chance. And quite often, I was able to get permission.
Done a panorama in the National Art Gallery. Took about 3 weeks to get permission to walk around with them. And they wouldn't let, there's so many places they wouldn't let me take pictures. But you might take a picture of the art. Now, of course, they're changing all the rules.
Yeah.
So you can do that. But still probably having a tripod stolen, probably a no-no, unless you've got a card.
Sometimes the tripod is a problem. Apparently in New York City, you can't deploy a tripod.
The NAC.
They can get permission for EC.
They will? Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay.
I have a friend, Susan, who's in a wheelchair, and I've used her numerous times.
Mm.
And she just cruises into position, and just bolt to the back of her chair and shoot anything out.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So there's lots of ways around that, and baby carriages and every other bloody thing under the planet can be used. You can be a bum with a shopping cart and this, you know, giant cinema camera. I mean, there's lots of ways around that. But yeah, the tripod is the classic. It's the one they all, that's photography.
Yeah.
That's when you say to them, no, I'm an Ontario surveyor. You can't touch
me. about stitch panoramas, what software do you use?
I tried the three. I'm using PD GUI.
Okay.
So, this is my fourth one.
Yeah. And that's what I use.
And could only work with PD GUI because of the fact that my environment is not static.
Okay.
Static. Yeah. It's not static. So, typically, when I get this thing in Photoshop. The way what I enable is 48 layers.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. 48 masks. Because if you're doing a panorama in a still environment, the automatic stitching will work really well. You don't have to do anything. But if you have something that is blurred, then it can't figure out the edges. And if you have things that overlap, as will sometimes happen, you can't figure out the edges. So out of 48 layers and masks, I would typically have to intervene manually on about 20 to 25% of them.
And you mean by?
By working the masks.
Restitch, you mean?
No. Just remove and add.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if I have this person that is that is blurred, yeah. And it tried to stitch something over, and it couldn't figure out if it's static, no problem. It couldn't figure out the blur. I will. So half of the person is hidden. In fact, half of the person is on the other mask. Yeah. Has been masked away by PD GUI. So I have to unmask this piece. Right. And about 20-25% of the layers, I have to do it. And I know no other system because I use PhotoMerge, Photoshop. I use whatever two or three.
Yeah.
Two, three other ones.
I've used Photoshop and I use PT GUI generally. I've done about 10,000 of them, and many of them in dynamic environments. And I do the same thing, make layers, unmask, adjust mask, stuff like that. I don't know of any other one that does as well as PT GUI for that.
Yep.
Yeah. Have you done any where you transition from one scene to another?
No, but that's interesting. This is something... that would be really interesting. I imagine like seasonally or nighttime, daytime, whatever. Yeah, that would be really interesting. Yeah, I've seen a project. Someone who did a 24 hour picture tracking the sun.
Oh yeah, cool.
So you see the sun. So you see daylight, and then it blends really well into the night. Okay, and then out. Okay. Yeah.
When you're doing your shooting, you're waiting for that ideal element to come through. Are you constantly looking through your viewfinder, or are you kind of set up an external monitor so you can see?
I have a shutter release, a cable release, and if I know that, oh wow, this person is coming, this is going to be good. So I position my camera exactly, and then I look through the viewfinder. Okay, she or he's going to be right in front of this door. And then I leave the viewfinder.
You just look at it. Just look
when
at
the person comes exactly where I want, I snap. So they don't even know that I snapped.
Have you had any issues with people walking by feeling like they want our picture taken or not?
Not a single time. No.
You have to keep your eyes open and out the corners of your eyes.
Yeah, you have to be. It's you know, if it takes 20 minutes, it's really hard work. I mean, you have to be really on the ball.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of undesirable effects you miss or something like that. And you thought this was a good picture, but then oh yeah, I forgot there's a foot of someone right there. So that's completely gone unless you you're able to mask out the foot. Sometimes it's possible, sometimes it's not possible.
No.
I have problems with cars. Cars is a problem because cars are long. So you have to wait for the red light to start shooting when the cars are stopped. A moving car, that is not a good thing at all, unless it's really small to get in inside one frame, but typically it's not the case. So cars are an issue. And I had a problem in Toronto with a billboard that was moving. The picture was changing, and that was an issue. Huh?
That couldn't
yeah.
My favorite one was ice coming, like on the bridge above the Rideau River at the rocks, or at the you know, waterfall, shooting the ice coming down the river at you.
Okay. One thing, this is going to be the last thing I'm going to say. I don't have an example here, but I switched from horizontal to vertical. I did four of those. Now, they were not 48 pictures because they were not like 20 to 1 because I was really, really too thin. I was 10 to 1 because I wanted to hang them as a vertical slice like this. Okay? So now, again, talking about techniques, it's got to be overcast. You have an issue because now you have ground which is dark and sky which is clear, so that's okay. The sky, it's completely white, wetted out, whatever you say. That's no problem. But then how do you do that? Well, I have an enduro extendable column that extends horizontally like this away from my tripod with a bag of sand weighing whatever, 10 kilos, whatever, really, really heavy to keep this thing from flipping. And then I go around like this. Now, I made an exception there. I was still on F29, but the hyperfocal couldn't work anymore. So I was on automatic autofocus. So when I shoot down on distance like this, and when I shoot up at the building, well, it's, you know, 20 meters away, so hyperfocal doesn't work here. It's too broad. So autofocus worked really well because as it changed, it adapted. And then you see the sidewalk, and then it goes around like this, see the building. But again, it's very, very difficult to get the right place because you don't want to have just a big strip of white sky at the top. So, for example, I shot on Spark Street. There was one place where if I looked up, the buildings were quite close, just visually like this. So I had a tiny strip of sky. That worked fine. And a couple of places in Ottawa. Actually, I was shooting. I was going to be kicked out, but I was shooting on the sidewalk on the other side of McKinsey in front of the U.S. Embassy. I was turning my back to them. And I was shooting on a sidewalk, and that's okay because there's a canopy on top. So I could go sidewalk, and then people, and then trees, and canopy, and then back down. You don't want to have clear sky again at the top. And again, I was there for 30 minutes, and I said, okay, it's only a matter of time. I'm going to get a guy on my back. Nope. I'm sure after 2 seconds, I had a gazillion people looking at me. But that worked out fine. So so that's a variant that I did, which worked out pretty good as well.
Yeah.
One challenge which you showed us is your display. Like at the city of Ottawa, I saw that you had like a band that you had sort of twisted.
Yeah.
So that's one example. You've done like a video, which is another like.
There are many variants that I did. One variant is I took four of these big panoramas and I put them one on top of the other, sort of a quadriptic. And again, this was a really real challenge, real interesting, because then I had to start to match the colors, because sometimes you have a little bit of a color tint in one, but if you just look at one, it doesn't matter. But if you have all of the one on top of the other, so there's a lot of color adjustment to get the right color feel across all four pictures. And then there was a composition problem. because I had to slice my panoramas to make sure that the eye would work its way nicely within this, you know, gigantic picture. And it was about, again, 25 foot long and four times this, so four times five feet high, okay? So huge print. So when I go to the printer, they said, no, you don't want to do this on paper. It's going to kink, it's going to scratch, it's going to whatever. Okay, help me. Okay, you want to do this on styrene, on plastic. So it's printed on plastic. And the way to display it is I put little eyelets at the bottom and at the top, and I just screw the thing straight in, into the wall. And what I discovered that's fantastic with that kind of material, it has no memory. Paper has memory. So you see, when you unfold, it's still round, whatever. This thing, it stays folded for a year. And when you unfold it, it's completely flat right away.
What do they call
that again? So, styrene, S-T-Y-R-E-N-E. And it's a really nice surface. It's sort of a semi-gloss velvet kind of surface. And the contrasts are really good. There's no bad color effect at all. It's just this. I mean, printers today are just unreal. It's unreal what you can do at a print shop. Professional printers.
Yeah.
That's where things are. That's really where things are in terms of the new printing technology and material and whatever.
So in your life of panorama, you've never shot film panorama, or have you?
No.
So you've never used a globoscope or rotocams?
No. That would be interesting. I suppose it'd be different.
What are the advantages of them? You don't do any stitching.
That's right, and then it's a real snapshot. Yeah,
so
you're pretty much.
It whirl around. Yeah. You get to 360 degrees, and it is what it is.
Yep.
So it offers the advantages of having you know people running in opposite directions with the blur or the scrunch, and all those sorts of things. It's just one.
I wonder if it may create a funny distortion as it sweeps across someone moving.
As the person is running towards the sweep, they'll become running with the sweep.
So that would be interesting, but then. I'm sure, yeah.
I shot a panoramic that was 2 inches long, by 14. I'm still trying to figure out how to mount it and how to display it.
Well, this one was mounted with magnets. So with paper, that's fine. That's a good way of mounting. It's inexpensive, and it works really well. So basically, put screws in the wall, and then you buy one of these rare earth magnets at Lee Valley. And it, they're about this far apart, and there's no problem. It holds perfect. If for a simple panorama, that's how I did it. That's how I would do it again. The styrene thing was, styrene could still work with magnets. It's a little bit heavier than paper, but I think it would still work. It's a nice, I had a chance to try this. It's a really, really nice surface, and it handles well. This was printed at Diamond in Gatineau. That's, classical paper. Then I dealt with a place in Montreal called, Corlab.
And your styrene?
Was printed at Corlab. But I found that there is a fantastic print shop called Optima in Hull. They are the guys who printed the big glacier the top of the National Gallery.
Oh.
They told me this is the biggest print project ever in Canadian history.
Wow.
They did it.
Optima.
Optima.
They said it's the biggest in the world?
They said Canada, right?
I don't know.
But they're really, really, really sharp. And they taught me a lot about surfaces and plastics and how to mount things and how to whatever, everything.
Sur
la rue Crémazie, just au bord de Saint-Joseph.
Are you tempted to break the record then?
Of what?
Break the record?
There's... well, in some sense, there's no limit to it. Right? Like, the good thing about this one, because it's 48 pictures, there's absolutely no interpolation. Like, the height is actually my number of pixels at 250 pixels per inch. Yeah. It's actually as it comes out of the camera, because of course the camera is vertical, so you take advantage of the high resolution dimension, and it's that's it. It's no interpolation whatsoever. These are the full pixels as they came out of the camera.
So then
zero interpolation. Exactly. You get something potentially something even more potential, right, if you want to go bigger. I love panoramas. I think they're cool, and I have more ideas about.
You did a presentation once at Ottawa School of Art where it was a Moebius strip.
Yeah.
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 I forget, how did it fit together?
Okay, so this is a mode of presentation because, again, I was thinking, okay, how do you show a 360 panorama? Well, you can, as we did here, you can put it on a wall and whatever. But then, of course, the two ends are not linked together. So some people in the past have displayed panoramas as cylinders. So you close, so you get inside and you see the panorama like this. But then, in a sense, the disadvantage of that is that you have an inside and an outside. So how can you avoid having an inside and an outside? Well, that's the Mobius strip. So this is another long story, because now you have a material problem with how you build a Mobius strip physically. I'll spare the details, but basically, in my latest incarnation of it, it's a self-adhesive vinyl put on polycarbonate plates, two of them, with holes and bolted on the side. So it's not completely smooth. That's a compromise I had to make. I'm sure someone, an engineer, could figure it out, but I couldn't figure it out. And I decided that was not that important. Get something that's completed. An eighth of an inch. If it's, again, trial and error. If it's too thin, it collapses on itself, and if it's too thick, then you can't bend it. So an eighth of an inch was a good compromise. And working with these guys, I gave them the pictures with the right overlap and everything. I told them they have machines to put the holes in the right place and then stick it exactly where it should go. And when it's all bolted, you see, of course, because you see the bolts and you see there's a line, but image-wise, there's no gap. It's completely smooth when you meet the edge. So have anybody seen those before?
Yeah, well, like
so it's suspended from the... No, not City Hall. I didn't show them at you mean Ottawa City Hall? No, that's something else. Okay. It's suspended from the ceiling, and it just hangs there, and you can follow with your eye. You can follow the 360 going in and out and so on. It's just another variant on that same idea, right, of panoramas.
Yeah, it was really good. Okay.